The subject we have tonight seems to be one of interest on a periodic basis. Demon possession and associated ideas have been quizzed about for quite a long time. I remember several cycles of interest in this issue, and there seemed to be a lot of questions about it at our particular time. I don't know why that is, but often it has to do with popular culture. Things that are relevant to the society at large seem to impact our thinking on a subject of this nature. I remember in 1971, William Peter Blatty wrote The Exorcist, and it became an immediate best-selling novel. A couple of years later, the film version of that novel was released under the same title, The Exorcist, and it gained worldwide attention. A lot of people became very concerned over the issue of demon possession. I never saw the film. I had no interest in seeing it, but I read a lot of reviews about it. I know that just a few years ago, it was reissued with additional footage that had not been a part of the original release. It depicts a young girl of the age of 12 who is possessed by a demon, and much of the film, according to the reviews, is devoted to a vivid description of her demon possession. Her face becomes swollen and pockmarked. She develops fangs in the corner of her mouth. She vomits a stream of green liquid. Her bed levitates from the floor. In the midst of her agony, she has to be bound to the bed. She has blood dripping from the corners of her mouth. She screams, groans, attacks herself, and speaks obscene words. In the middle of all this, two priests from the Church of Rome come to try to exorcise or cast out the demon. One of these priests is an older man and dies of an apparent heart attack during the midst of the incantations, prayers, sprinkling of holy water, and the waving of gold crosses. He dies of a heart attack, but the younger priest continues on and eventually succeeds in getting the demon to leave the girl and enter his own body, and then he jumps out the window, destroying himself and supposedly the demon on the concrete below. Is this demon possession? Well, when we look at a careful examination of the biblical cases of demon possession, we don't find much that even remotely resembles films like The Exorcist or other spin-offs of that that we've had through the years. So we need to look at what the Bible says and not be too worried about what's being said about us, about it in the popular culture of the world. The word exorcist is only used one time in the Bible, and that's in Acts chapter 19, verse 13, where there were some vagabond Jews who were attempting to exorcise or cast out demons. I know you remember the case from the 19th chapter of Acts. They attempted to cast out demons in the name of Jesus, whom Paul preaches, but the demon said, remember, Jesus I know and Paul I know, but who are you? And then instead of them casting the demon cast them out of the house, and they went on their way and were unsuccessful in that attempt. Exorcism is the expulsion of demons or malign spirits by conjuration and or prayer. The Church of Rome has always been interested in this and thought that they could do it, although usually with just two or three authenticated supposedly cases in each century. The Episcopalian Church also believes that they are able to do this. But as we look at it, we have to be bound by the Word of God. We have to be bound around completely by what the Bible says. We just can't validate the Scriptures by our experiences. We have to validate our experiences by what the Scriptures say. One of the great dangers we face as we enter this 21st century is that we have so many subjective attitudes instead of a love of objective truth. And people will say, in effect, if not in actuality, I know how I feel. I know what's going on inside of me, and it doesn't matter what you read to me out of that book or any other book. I know how I feel, and that's the end of it for me. The problem with that is that if your experience is the basis of truth, then I can never know the truth because I cannot enter into you and have your experience. On the other hand, if the truth is in this book, then we can study it together and we can arrive at truth together. Remember, we heard earlier in the meeting that truth is the way things really are. Truth is that which corresponds to reality. So that's what we're looking for on this or any other subject. And I want to take some general statements and get a little more specific as we go along. First, it seems from the Bible that there are three realms inhabited by intelligent beings. And in Philippians 2:10, for example, these areas are called heaven and earth and something called under the earth. Heaven is the celestial sphere. It's inhabited by what we generally call angels, angelic messengers, celestial messengers. Earth, this terrestrial sphere, is inhabited by human beings. Under the earth would be the infernal realm, which is inhabited by demons. Now, the Jews had a lot of fantasy about the angelic world. They had developed concepts that are far beyond anything we have in the Bible. The Bible does speak of seraphim one time, and it speaks of cherubim about 80 times. The Jews had all of this outlined. The Bible only speaks about one archangel, for example, Michael the archangel, indicating there may possibly be only one archangel. I don't know. But the Jews said there were seven of them. They had them all named, Raphael and Muriel, and they thought Gabriel was an archangel. Well, I don't know. We only have the ability to substantiate any of these things by what the Bible itself says. That's the only authoritative message that we have. The Greeks, correspondingly, had other names for some of these same areas. They talked about thrones, dominions, principalities and powers, and mights. And we know these referred to angelic beings because the Apostle Paul says in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12, that we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. That shows that principalities and powers are not flesh and blood. So we're interested tonight in this area under the earth, as it was called in typical terminology of that time, the infernal realm where the demons reside. How do these beings happen to exist in the first place? I believe that demons are fallen angels. We have in 2 Peter 2, verse 4, God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to Tartarus, or Tartaro, as somebody told me that ought to be pronounced, Tartaro, is that right? Somebody tell me, because I don't know, but that's the only time that expression, Tartarus, the original root, appears in the Bible anywhere, in 2 Peter 2:4. That shows us that there were angels that sinned, and that God cast them down to hell. He put them into chains, meaning that they were restricted or restrained. They were no longer free to come and go. In the sixth verse of the book of Jude, we have just a little more information about it. The angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness, under the judgment of that great day. They left their position, meaning that they got out of their place. And so they were chained. When you're chained, you can't go anywhere. Now, their leader was not chained. Their leader was called Satan, with a capital S, meaning adversary, or devil, with a capital D, meaning accuser. He was still able, in the days of Job, to go to and fro in the earth and walk up and down in it. He was the prince of the power of the air and was not so restricted. But the demons themselves, his followers, were restricted in chains. The only time Jesus ever painted a picture of the last great judgment scene is recorded in the 25th chapter of the book of Matthew, verses 31 through 46. And it's the time when he says that when the Son of Man shall come in his glory and all the holy angels with him, he shall sit upon the throne of his glory, and before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from the other as the shepherd divideth the sheep from the goats. And then he tells us that he's going to issue an invitation to those on his right hand, come ye blessed of my Father, but to those on his left hand who have not fulfilled his purpose in life for them, he's going to say, depart ye cursed into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels. The devil has angels. They are apparently the same angels as the angels that sin. And their hell was prepared for the devil and his angels. To choose to follow the devil is to choose to go where he's gone. The demons are personalities. These are individual creations. They are not diseases or states or conditions. I don't believe there is a demon of cancer or a demon of tobacco or a demon of alcohol or a demon of poverty or hatred or lust. I remember back in the early 70s, though, there was so much interest in this. People were making a lot of money writing books about it and selling them and stumping the country. I remember I was living over in Topeka, Kansas at the time, and I went to a large assembly hall. Many hundreds of people were gathered there to listen to a man who had written books on this subject, and he was going to give a public demonstration of the casting out of demons. It was advertised that way. If you've got demons, come and get them cast out by this man. His name was Don Basham. I don't know anything about him since that time. But Don Basham got up and primed the pump for about an hour and a half, I think. He talked so long, I was able to leave the assembly and go get my girlfriend, who's now my wife. She was working at Sears at the time. Went to Sears and picked her up, and then we both went back over to this place, and he was still going. But he started making a list on the blackboard. It was blackboards at that time. He made a list of all the varieties of demons that were present. Now, is there anybody here who's got the demon of tobacco? Well, a lot of people raised their hands, so he put that down. Made a whole list. I think there were three columns on this blackboard. And he said, now I'm going to cast these out, and there's nothing mystical about or magical about this. It's a very simple procedure. When I cast out your particular demon, you'll feel a tickling in the back of your throat, and just let yourself go ahead and cough. Let it come on out. He was very dramatic and elaborate about all of this, and then he started calling them out. Who's got the demon of alcohol? All right, come on out of these people in the name of the Lord, you know. And people started coughing all over the auditorium. Who's got the demon of tobacco? And people started coughing all over the auditorium. And as this went on, he started grouping them together, and people would just be coughing everywhere. Some of them were spitting up phlegm on the rug. And I have to admit that my throat started to tickle. It's contagious. If somebody starts yawning over here, pretty soon we've got yawns all across the room. Believe me, I've seen it more than anybody. It's contagious. There's nothing magical about it. So after we left that night, a couple hours later, I have to admit I was even more skeptical of this whole process than I had been when I went. But at least I had seen what the process was. Now the Bible teaches us that demons are spirits. Mark chapter 2, verse 5, verse 8, and verse 13. Verse 12 calls these entities demons. Verse 13 calls them spirits. Demons can cry out, Mark chapter 5, verse 7. Demons can give their name, Mark chapter 5, verse 9. Our name is Legion. There are a mob of us inhabiting this man. Demons recognized Jesus, Mark 1, 34. How could they possibly recognize Jesus? They were inhabiting people who'd never been where Jesus was, didn't know Jesus from Adam, and yet they said, Jesus, thou son of David. How'd they know him? They'd been in heaven with him. That's how. Thousands of years before, they'd been in heaven with him because Jesus himself created these entities who later became the angels that sinned. So, of course, they knew him. Demons can believe, which is a mark of an intelligent being. James 2:19. You believe there's one God? Well, you're doing great. You can join hands with the demons on that because the demons also believe and tremble. They tremble because they know their fate. Demons are intelligent personalities. They are not shortcomings and they are not character traits. Mary Magdalene has gotten a bad reputation in popular culture as having been a prostitute. The New Testament nowhere says that she was ever a prostitute, but since the Lord cast seven demons out of her, some people have concluded, I think it may have been Cecil B. DeMille who popularized the idea in one of his films. He showed the demons being cast out of her, and she was made to look as though she had been an immoral woman who was guilty of prostitution. But we look at the New Testament, we see that the demons did not only inhabit people who were wicked and vile. Sometimes they inhabited the young. My son falls into the water sometimes, he falls into the fire other times. The reason that you have problems interiorly is not because of the demons. It's because the devil brought sin into the world by the consent of the tempted parties, and you have participated in that. And Jesus did not say that from the demons proceed all these problems. He said it's from the heart of man that these things proceed. Therefore, we can't say the devil made me do it or the demons made me do it. And in most cases, the thing for us to do is not to cast out the demon, but to clean up our hearts. Demon possession is not insanity, nor is demon possession any kind of an abnormal mental condition. Your mind can get sick just like your body can get sick. And God makes a distinction. He makes differences between these things. I'll just read one little passage from the fourth chapter of the book of Matthew because Jesus was just beginning his public ministry at this time. And there's a whole catalog of things that he was doing. I'll start in Matthew 4:23. Jesus went about all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and preaching the gospel of the kingdom and healing all manner of sickness and all manner of disease among the people. And his fame went throughout all Syria. And they brought unto him all sick people that were taken with divers diseases and torments, and those which were possessed with demons. The King 1769 King James Version says devils, but there aren't devils. There's only one devil with a capital D, meaning accuser. The word here is daimonion, which means demons. Those who were possessed with demons, that's one category. And there are also those that were lunatic, those that had the palsy, and he healed them. He dealt with all these varieties of categories. There were diseases, which were seemingly interior sicknesses that couldn't necessarily be seen, but were problematic for people. There were torments, which involved physical pain that was almost unendurable. There was demon possession, which is a special category, but there were also people that were lunatic, literally moonstruck, which they thought was happening because they were under the influence of the moon, and there was probably some epilepsy involved in this. There was also palsy. And a number of different things here. I think I can help us clear this up, because a lot of times people think, well, they just didn't understand mental illness at that time, and what they call demon possession is what we call mental illness today. Nothing could be further from the truth than that. We have these distinctly divided from one another, and they're quite different. The New Testament verifies that these are quite different from each other. Demons differ from insanity or disordered minds in this way. Insane people either reason rightly on wrong grounds, or they reason wrongly on right grounds, or they get the two of them confused. They get all mixed up. But the demons reasoned rightly on right grounds. Everything the demons said was right from their point of view. It was appropriate. It was adapted to the situation. Even if they were lying, they were lying for a reason that made sense to them. So there was nothing insane about the demons. They were wrong, they were evil, but they were not causing people to exhibit the characteristics, except on a superficial level perhaps. The people did not exhibit the characteristics. The people the demons inhabited knew more than they would have if the demons had not inhabited them. It's not like they were progressing in a reverse way intellectually. They actually knew more than they would have otherwise. So while those two may look alike sometimes, they're not the same thing at all. Now, another point, as we get a little more specific here, we have to ask ourselves the question, why is it when we read the Bible, we read clear through the whole Old Testament, and we don't find demon possession there? Where do we ever even come close to demon possession in the whole Old Testament? We've got the case of King Saul, but there was an evil spirit that came and afflicted him. It was upon him, but it wasn't within him in the sense of being possessed by a demon. It was upon him because it had a punitive purpose. And this permission was granted by God. God uses evil to chastise evil sometimes. So God sent it as a punishment, but showing that not even evil spirits can go forth without his permissive will. But it didn't mean that God caused Saul to sin in any way. Saul was still in charge of himself. This was just a spirit of affliction to punish him. So I couldn't call that demon possession. In 1 Kings 22, we have the case of Micaiah, with which I think you're pretty familiar, where I'll be a lying spirit in his mouth, and I don't have time to go through the whole story, but I think you know it. That, again, is not a case of demon possession. It's just a voluntary evil being volunteering to go on an evil mission, and he was allowed to do that. But that's not demon possession. We read through the whole Old Testament, we don't find it. But suddenly we hit the Gospels, and then it's all over the place. Especially in the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it's just all over the place. Fully one-fourth of the miraculous ministry of Jesus is the casting out of demons. So what's going on with that? Because then when we hit the book of Acts, there's very little about it. And then in the epistles, very little about it. So it's just mainly during the time that Jesus was here. This is why I believe that the demons were released in the days of Jesus so that he could show his power over them. If he was going to be Lord of all, if he was going to show that, then he had to show ability not only over angels and over humans, but he had to show that same authority over the demons of hell. And he was certainly able to do that. They obeyed him. They were forced to obey him. They didn't have any choice. I think this at least helps me to understand, and there are indications that what I'm saying to you is absolutely true. For instance, Jesus, thou son of David, said the demons. This is Matthew 8:29. Art thou come hither to torment us before the time? What time are they talking about? I believe the time they're talking about is the time that they would have to retire from the scene on earth. because they've been released for a special purpose, and they knew that they were going to have to go back to those same chains that they'd been in when, since the time that God originally put them, when they had been cast out of heaven at the beginning. They were having a field day on earth, making people do all kind of things that they didn't have any control over, and they didn't want to go back. They were even willing to go into a herd of unclean hogs rather than to have to go back. Because apparently, demons are not able to remain on earth unless they can inhabit a body. Otherwise, they wouldn't have had to ask about that. That's the only sense I can make. I don't think for a minute that demons come and inhabit your house and haunt it at night, make the cupboards rattle and all of that. I don't think demons come upon your little baby children and cause them to cry out at night. When your children cry out at night, that's the same thing you used to do to your parents, and your children are just chips off the old block. You're getting paid back for what you did when you were little. There's nothing mysterious about that. So we don't need to make this any more mysterious than it is. Disembodied spirits apparently cannot stay here, at least those evil spirits. I do believe that there are angels, possibly angels in this room right now, that don't need to inhabit other areas. But the demons are not in that category. They apparently cannot remain. That's why they were willing to go into the hogs, and when they ran the hogs into the sea, they apparently had to go back anyway to be reserved in those chains. This has to do with what Jesus did. When he ascended up on high, he led captivity captive, meaning that he led a multitude of captives with him. The demonic forces were taken into captivity by Jesus, who cast them out. Just a very few of them remained around after Jesus was gone so that his appointed apostles could show their apostolic authority over them. But by the time we get to the end of Acts, even well before the book of Acts ends, we're not reading about demon possession anymore. So this was a special thing for a special time. Jesus defeated and disarmed all the demonic forces. And I want to read to you just a couple of verses from the second chapter of the Colossian letter, which I think are quite pertinent right here at this place. Colossians chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. This is what Jesus did when he died on the cross. Blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us, which was contrary to us, he took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross. And having spoiled, which does not mean to pamper, this is a King James issue again, we're not talking about pampering, we're talking about making a spoiled of. Having spoiled principalities and powers, remember what principalities and powers are. That's not flesh and blood. These are the demonic forces. Having spoiled principalities and powers, he made a show of them openly, triumphing over them in it, that is, in his cross. So many things happened when Jesus died on the cross that we're not even yet fully aware of. So much was going on at that particular moment. So he led them as captives in his triumphal procession, and the demons tonight are right back where God originally put them when they were cast out of heaven. They are in those chains again. I do not believe that demons inhabit the bodies of people today ever. I've known of many, many cases where people believed it, and I've been called in to try to help deal with situations like that, but I've never seen one single case in all these years that I even came close to believing was actual demon possession. But if that's true, and these are evil forces that inhabit these chains, how do demons function today? Do they have any abilities at all? Oh, they certainly do. They have tremendous abilities. These are extremely bright creatures. I don't know how much smarter they are than us, but they're considerably smarter than us. I have wondered if they're not maybe 50 times as intelligent as we are. And not only that, but they've got all these thousands of years of experience, and they don't miss much. They know all about what your great-grandfather was like and his great-grandfather, and all the propensities through all of time, the genetic bents that have been passed down in your family. This is one way the devil knows how to adjust what the temptations are going to be that come to you personally. They've got all this information, and they're better than computers. They don't miss much. So we don't want to minimize their importance in the world. They certainly have a place. We're told in 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1, by the Apostle Paul speaking prophetically, that in the latter times some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of demons. What's he talking about there? I believe what he's saying is that demons in our time, in these latter times, operate not through personal invasion or possession, but they operate now through false teaching and deception. I believe that all false doctrines originate in hell, every one of them. The demons think these up with their warped minds, and then it seems that they seek to implant these in willing human minds. Just as the treasure of the gospel is in earthen vessels, and the angels would never, even an angel that got Philip down to where the eunuch was, that angel would not preach the gospel to the eunuch. Wouldn't it have been a lot simpler for the angel just to preach the gospel? Why get Philip down there? But the treasure is in earthen vessels, our earthen vessels. We're the ones. We're not only plan A, but we're plan B also. If we don't do this work, then I guess it just won't be done. The angels would not or could not preach the gospel to people, and it seems that perhaps the human beings are the ones who have to promulgate the false doctrines too if these doctrines are going to be advocated. I don't get any indication that the demons can do much about that otherwise. I don't know. I don't know how restricted they are. I don't know. I would like to know. I would like to know what happened in that cave 3 miles outside of Mecca when Muhammad said that he saw a shining entity who said that he was Gabriel and gave him this message. I'd like to know. Did Muhammad really see anything? I don't know. Could he have seen anything? I don't know. There's just so much I don't know, you know. I would love to know. But it seems that something was going on there. It seems to me that it's possible that maybe Muhammad had a little help in some way, but I don't know how. Maybe it was just implanted into his mind somehow through the perhaps the spiritual equivalent of radio waves. That's the best I can do for you on that particular issue. You know, there are physical radio waves in this room right now. We could probably, if we had a radio and turned it on, we could find 100 different stations, and nobody would be surprised at that because we understand the concept. The same thing very well could be true on a spiritual basis, that the demons look for susceptible minds. They know more about you than you know about yourself. They look for susceptible minds. I think this would be a good doctrine for him. Yeah, let's try to put that in there. Let's try to present that to him in some manner. I think he might well fall for that. I don't doubt that they have these kinds of discussions. You know, they've always been involved in these false doctrines. Back in the book of Leviticus, chapter 7, verse 17, I'm not going to take the time to look at it. You've had a big weekend, and I appreciate very much your attention. So I want to treat you right here. But in Deuteronomy 32, verse 17, we read about the demons that were behind the gods. You know, Paul said an idol is nothing, and that's true. An idol is nothing. That piece of stone or wood means nothing. But yet, it was a demonic force that somehow invented the concept that caused people to want to create that god. Whether it was a goat god or whatever, back here in these passages it talks about goat gods. Now just because you worshipped a goat god didn't make the goat a god, but it did give honor to the demon who invented that god. And I think that's what Paul is indicating, isn't it? In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, when he says, I don't want you to be worshiping at the table of demons. He's indicating that there are demonic forces behind these idols, even though the idol itself is nothing. But there was something behind that concept that was created by the demons. So we need to think in those terms. The seduction and instruction that they do is a serious business. All idolatry springs from this. When Joseph Smith went into that grove and he talks about the angelic forces that he saw and he got these revelations, did he have extra help? I think in some way he surely did. And I don't know just to what extent, but the people who follow Joseph Smith have always said, well, how could this ignorant young boy have come up with all this? Well, maybe he did have some help. I wouldn't be surprised at all. But to what extent, I don't know. I don't know how far their abilities reach. I would love to know more. But I do know this much about it. Rather than trying to cast demons out of people who aren't inhabited by demons in the first place, we fight demons today by opposing false doctrines of men who have not the faith. That much I know. Every time you oppose a false doctrine of man, you are fighting the demons in probably the most effective way possible. There are a couple more things I'd like to get to before we have to conclude. One of them is in the 16th chapter of the book of Mark. In Mark chapter 16, Jesus, after his resurrection, is dealing with the apostles, and the issue is their unbelief. That's key to our understanding of this. Afterward, this is 16:14 of the book of Mark. Afterward, he appeared unto the 11. Judas is dead. He's killed himself. And he's got 11. Jesus has 11 apostles yet. In Acts, you know, there will be a 12th added as a replacement. Afterward, he appeared unto the 11 as they sat at meat and upbraided them with their unbelief and hardness of heart because they believed not them which had seen him after he was risen. And he said unto them, go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, but he that believeth not shall be damned. And these signs shall follow them that believe. In my name shall they cast out demons, and they shall speak with new tongues, they shall take up serpents, and if they drink any deadly thing it shall not hurt them, they shall lay hands on the sick, and they shall recover. Now, a lot of people have trouble with this. There are many religious organizations that believe that these things apply to every member of their religious organization. I've talked with many, many, there are big religious organizations that believe that. I've sat with people who told me that if I were to be bitten by a poisonous snake, it wouldn't affect me at all. I sat with the man from Joseph Smith's organization. I went with a couple of the guys that come around from door to door, and we talked in the visitor center in Independence for several hours about the doctrines of that church. This man was high up in the Mormon church. I don't know exactly what his position was, but he had a name that was, he was sprung right from the root and stock of the Mormon hierarchy. And a very important man. He said, if I were to drink anything deadly, it wouldn't affect me at all. He didn't know me, and I was just sitting there with him. He had a cup of coffee. I said, when you turn your head, I'm going to put strychnine in your coffee and test your theory. His answer baffled me. He said, you do that and you'll be tried for murder. What? Quite a disconnect. All of a sudden, truth comes rushing in. We get real serious about it. Somebody's going to die? You just told me. If you drink any deadly thing, it won't hurt you. This is a problem for a lot of people, but if we put it in the context of Jesus talking to the apostles, I think it clears up most of it immediately. They're the ones who had a problem with unbelief. These were the emissaries that were going to be sent out, and they had trouble with unbelief. Jesus is trying to correct that, and he's upbraiding them for the problem. Go ye, he's talking to them, it says in verse 15. Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel. This is a special commission given to that special group of people called, qualified, and commissioned to fulfill that. They could speak in tongues that they'd never had to take time to study before. These are the apostles of Jesus Christ. We don't have anybody alive on earth like that in our time. This commission was given to the same group of people the original commission was given back in Matthew chapter 10. Go ye not in the way of the Gentiles, and into any city of the Samaritans enter ye not, but go ye rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Now he's saying, I've finished my work on earth, I've died, I've raised from the dead, now go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. Same group of people. They fulfilled this commission during their lifetime. So the apostles said their line went out into all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. And he says in Colossians 1:23 that the gospel was preached to every creature under heaven within that one generation. So they fulfilled it, and they need no successors to office because they fulfilled their commission. You and I are operating under an evangelistic commission now. Preach the word, be instant in season, out of season, reprove, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine. But we're not under this per se. It's good to go into all the world and preach the gospel, yes. But this was fulfilled during the lifetime of the original apostles and those who were succeeders like Matthias and the apostle Paul. So that's the people that he's talking to, and if we read it that way, we see in verse 17, these signs shall follow them that believe, those of you who believe. In my name shall you cast out demons, they shall speak with new tongues, they shall take up serpents. And the Apostle Paul did that one time inadvertently, gathering wood on the island of Melita. He took up a serpent, it bit him with no ill effect, so that the people thought he was something special on that island. You remember the story. We don't have an example of them drinking up any deadly thing, but it could happen so easily, because these people were going to have a lot of opposition, and everybody has to drink, and drinks can be fixed. So they were equipped by God, especially here. If you drink any deadly thing, it shall not hurt you. They probably did that, and we just don't have records of it. He's talking about the apostles of Christ. They shall lay hands on the sick and they shall recover, and we have lots of examples of that. So then, verse 19, after the Lord had spoken unto them, he was received up into heaven and sat on the right hand of God, and they went forth and preached everywhere, the Lord working with them and confirming the word with signs following. The signs of an apostle were wrought among you, says the apostle at the end of the 2 Corinthian letter. That all dovetails together pretty well. I believe that Mark chapter 16 needs to be taken into account here. This is not giving everybody in the family of God the ability to cast out demons. The apostles of Christ and other select individuals had that ability. One more thing before we quit. And again, I appreciate your wonderful attention. It's amazing to me. You can sit there. You know, some of us get to get up here and move around a little bit, but you guys just sit there. You're so attentive, or you've become real good at looking real attentive. There's one more passage that I think bears impertinence here. And this is back in the Old Testament in the 13th chapter of the book of Zechariah. We don't have time for a book of Zechariah study right now, and nobody wants it. But one of the key phrases, I know you don't, one of these key phrases in Zechariah is "in that day." And it seems that to me that the expression "in that day" in Zechariah is referring to the day that Jesus died on the cross and further actions that were triggered by this. With that little context, which I hope is enough, just think of Zechariah chapter 13, verses 1 and 2. In that day shall be a fountain open to the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and uncleanness. That happened at the cross. And it shall come to pass, in that context, saith the Lord, that the prophet and the unclean spirit shall pass out of the land. And prophets did pass out of land. There were New Testament prophets, but they were already passing away very early. As there were false prophets among them, so there shall be false teachers among you. Peter makes a contrast there in 2 Peter 2, because the prophets were going to pass away. Prophecy was not going to be involved anymore, because we didn't need more. God gave us everything we needed right here. And God doesn't have to be talking all the time after he's already revealed his will. He already gave us. So the prophet did pass out of land, and the unclean spirit passed out of the land as well. But while demon possession is not a promise for our time, the indwelling Holy Spirit of God certainly is a promise for our time. And if you are outside of Jesus Christ tonight and would come to him in simple trusting faith, we want everybody to understand that God has only required two things in any era of time. He's only required two things in the whole history of the world. Two things of humanity are required. Number one is trust, which is the same as faith. And number two is obedience that's based on that faith. Trust and obey. What a great song to end with. It couldn't be put any more succinctly. If you need to obey the Lord in primary obedience, or if you have anything else to bring before the assembled brethren here, please let us know how we can help you by coming forward to one of these front chairs as we stand together and sing one more song.